heart and soul of a nation, beckons the call. The voice of our forefathers heard in the distance.
A house divided against itself cannot stand.
To reclaim our honor.
Our soul. The challenges of a generation call out. Future generations hang in the balance. We choose liberty. This is the voice of a nation.
The nation.
And now, Malcolm.
Well, there's one common thread that many of these stories that that I bring you often on this program and on the network, there's a common thread with a lot of these stories, people, and that is that they're void of any logic. They don't have logic. And this is another one of those stories today where you scratch your head. And specifically, what I'm talking about today is what government is doing with drug traffickers and pain patients. I mean, you got two different forces here with the drug problem and crisis that's going on in the United States. And here's another twist to this thing, and the billions and billions of dollars that are going to fight drugs in other countries. And when I started to see some of these stories and some of the numbers behind this, it's unbelievable. And you'll be outraged when you hear some of the stats, some of the numbers that we have on this problem today. Let's start first here. What are opioids? The National Institute on Drug Abuse says that opioids are a class of drugs that include the illegal drug heroin, synthetic opioids such as fentanyl, and pain relievers available legally by prescription, such as oxycodone, hydrocodone, codeine, morphine, many others. Vicodin, you know, the usual suspects there, these narcotic-type medications. And there's a whole litany list of these things, and sometimes they're necessary if you're in a whole heap of pain, and we've seen that. But what's happening is there's two wars going on here that I'm seeing here that are being they're being mangled by the feds, by the government. You know, they're being mangled. They're being confused, and we're putting the attention at the wrong places. And then on top of it, I got to tell you something else. The dollars we spend dealing with drugs in just Afghanistan alone, we could solve the drug problem here in its entirety. And I'll get into that more in a moment here. Let me bring your attention first to a couple of interesting editorials that I think shed some really good light on this problem here. Okay. And the first is The Government's War on Pain Patients. This is from Daniel Horowitz. And he says, if congressional legislators are committed to letting out transnational drug traffickers from prison, can they at least give pain patients consuming prescription drugs some relief too? And he goes on to say, one could not possibly conceive of a more perverse, unjust, and counterintuitive policy than what government is doing with drug traffickers and pain patients. Now, Daniel hits it pretty well here in this article here. He says the federal and state governments are inviting in criminal alien drug traffickers, protecting them with sanctuary cities, releasing hardened traffickers of illicit drugs from prison, and then attacking doctors and pain patients who prescribe and consume legitimate pain medication. It's about impossible to top what I just fed to you, okay? It's immoral, he says. It's built upon a lie, and it's time for it to end. The entire baseline increase in drug fatalities during this epidemic was due to illicit street drugs brought in by open borders and sheltered by sanctuary cities. Funny how it always comes back to that, people, huh? The crisis was not the result of prescription drugs. Prescriptions have been plummeting since before the epidemic, and prescription deaths are down. Now, I thought that was some eye-opening information here to have this conversation with you all from Horowitz here. Let me read you this other piece here. Former U.S. drug czar says national focus on opioid epidemic is overlooking the real culprit. And this is from Elizabeth Lorente, and it was in a Fox News piece here. She goes on to say, Many states have implemented strict regulations as a result of a 2016 CDC guideline on opioid prescribing. Now, the CDC has said often that the guideline was not meant to be enforced and that it was issued to help primary care physicians prescribing opioids to a first-time user. And now, listen to this here. Most people, the vast majority of people, in fact, who are prescribed these painkillers do not abuse them. Now, we're talking that, you know, it's, don't you find it's always the minority? It's also, it's always that 1% that screw everything up. That's a hard, fast rule you can use in life everywhere, people. And here's the thing about the 1%. They always get the attention of everybody, the extremists. In every, no matter what conversation I have with you on any given day, that 1% is the real pain in the ass here. It doesn't matter what we're talking about, but they're the ones who get the time and attention, always. And they're the ones who get the media and they get the politicians. It's that 1%. Now, to finish this here, the CDC had to come back and issue another kind of guidance, saying a lot of people who need pain pills are not getting them. And this has kind of become a whole problem in itself, people. Both the CDC and the Food and Drug Administration, the lovable FDA, they warned doctors, this is just about a month or so ago, not to abruptly stop prescribing opioid painkillers to patients, please, who are taking them for chronic debilitating pain. And let's face it, chronic pain, people, it varies, but typically it's pain that's more than 3 months. Some it's 6 months. And some want to make it a year versus acute pain. So that's the difference between the two. So you're informed here, you see? Okay. All right. So if you got all that now, so you see, we have two wars going on here. Okay. And Horowitz points out perfectly. So the border problem, the crisis problem, the drug problem coming across, I mean, this is a unbelievable problem beyond anything. And the cartels are loving this. In fact, we pointed out on our weekend show on Viewpoint that this is, you know, they run the entire country. They have jurisdictions here in the United States, which we'll get into a little bit after here. And these people, and then, you know, we're such fools. And then we set up all these sanctuary cities and sanctuary states and markets to give them cover. I mean, you just can't believe this stuff. I, for one, being a logic member, I started this by saying void of logic. You know, that's void of logic. I mean, it's not real complicated, people. You know, 2 + 2 = 4, right? Well, not when it's the government. They have a different math they use up there, you see, you know. Now, buckle your seatbelt for what I tell you next, because this will really piss you off. In the midst of an opioid epidemic here in the United States, the government, our United States government, has blown billions of dollars to treat drug addiction in Afghanistan. And follow me closely on this now, people, so you can get the whole feeling and benefit of being pissed off. So just follow me carefully here. So to treat drug addiction in Afghanistan, and they have no clue if the programs are working. They not have a clue in the world. So listen to these numbers here. Since 2002, American taxpayers, yeah, that's all of you out there. It's all of us, people. That's correct, right? Take a look around. Since 2002, American taxpayers have doled out an eye-popping 9 billion smackaroos, 9 billion. If I'm pronouncing this properly to you, or I can do it phonetically as well, this is billion with a B, B as in bullshit. You see what I mean? Okay, so that's the B we're talking about here. So it's $9 billion to counter drug production in the Islamic nation. They are the world's top opium producer. Everybody knows that. That's probably a Jeopardy question at this point, right? So the money largely flows through the State Department's Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs. And listen, as part of the broader effort, Uncle Sam spent Well, just over $50 million on dozens of drug treatment programs between 2013 and 2018 as well. And guess who runs those? The United Nations on Drugs. And of course, that's a statement in itself, United Nations on Drugs, because you could believe that in a heart second, clearly, right? I mean, that's not a stretch at all that they're United Nations on Drugs, but obviously the money they're wasting on the program is unbelievable. So the problem is that, like many of these costly government initiatives and specifically these global initiatives, well, what the feds do is they sit their fat asses in those fat offices up in Washington and they write the big checks, but they don't bother to follow up to know if anything's working. That's not even a concern to them, people. Doesn't even come into the radar with them, because after all, it's not really their money and they don't have a problem with that. Now, a report published by the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction slams the government for failing to monitor or evaluate the performance of its drug addiction projects in Afghanistan. And they write that the State Department does not know the impact to date of its investment. Furthermore, the State Department didn't even bother to conduct site visits to project locations and failed to maintain files or records required under agency rules. Isn't that special? Isn't that special? You know, Afghanistan has among the world's highest per capita rates of drug users. It's a wonder they're so screwed up out there, people. They're all on drugs. I mean, we're talking between 3 and 3.6 million. And among the favorite drugs are, you guessed it, opium and heroin are among 31% of all Afghan households have at least one member who uses drugs. That's a third of the households in Afghanistan are on drugs. I mean, the State Department has tried to justify funding projects to counter the problem by pointing out that drug addiction causes a wide range of detrimental societal efforts beyond health and welfare, undermining economic development, reducing social and political stability, and diminishing security. No kidding. Why don't they take a look at the urban centers and cities and markets in the United States of America, and they can see all the things they just pointed out and how detrimental that is to the health of all Americans. That would be an interesting place to start. Well, the U.S. government has spent, listen to these numbers. I was beyond dumbfounded. I didn't have a clue. I had no, and you probably don't have a clue either. So let me clue you in as I clued myself in. The United States government, you almost can't say those words anymore and have any kind of a good feeling when you finish the int at the end of government. You can't have a good feeling when you say U.S., you think about it, U.S. government. As soon as you say that, you've got hostilities in your body from left to right, up and down, right? You can't, just as soon as you finish that T sound, you know you're ripping pissed. Well, the U.S. government has spent just shy of $9 billion, exactly $8.9 billion. Again, phonetically, the B. I'm pronouncing the B for bullshit again, so you understand where I'm going. So the $8.9 billion on counter-narcotics efforts in Afghanistan. This was an audit now. So far, it's been a humiliating failure. In fact, a few years ago, listen to this, Judicial Watch. I love the work Judicial Watch does, because they try to keep all these cats on their toes, which is not an easy job, people. I mean, if I could do 1% or 5% of what Judicial Watch is doing, that's my motive as well, is to keep all these people on their toes and help us all be better informed, clearly. So Judicial Watch says that the multi-billion dollar investment actually resulted in a huge increase in Afghan poppy cultivation and opium production. Isn't that sweet, huh? Talk about wasted money, people. I mean, unbelievable. You just can't. And then you see the urban core and the destruction of America's cities, which I've been talking to you about, what's happening from coast to coast, right? Coast to coast. We've spent more money in these kinds of markets. And Afghanistan's not the only one, people. It's one of a myriad of countries that we could go on and on. And it's just, And then we want to talk about what's the matter with our infrastructure? What's the matter with our drug problem? What's the matter with our urban cities? What's the matter with everything that's going on here? Well, you can't imagine what's the matter when there's no money left and they sit up there and fight about what's left after they dole all this money out. So, people, the question you want to ask yourself today, are politicians focusing on the wrong opioid crisis war? That's the first big question you have to ask yourself. And again, if these massive amounts of deadly drug fentanyl and other street drugs laced with fentanyl are poured into the country through the borders, not so much the doctor-prescribed pain medication, which, you know, could be a problem in itself, but that's not the big elephant in the room here, if you will, or the big jackass in this case as well, no matter what you have in the room here. But people, I'll tell you what, this is just makes you so sick when you understand what's happening. And then we go on and we talk about a war on drugs. I think people at this moment of time, I think it's about ready for a new war. And it's called a war on politicians, a war on Washington, D.C. Buckle yourself up and let's have that conversation ahead, huh?
Listen to Malcolm, the voice of a nation, on iHeartRadio or our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa.
It's your news and entertainment network. News blogs, informative podcasts, entertaining videos, or listen to 24/7 talk radio on our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. We the people. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio. Okay, so I lay out some compelling facts and data there in the opening comments to this conversation. Now let's have a real talk here. And I've got two very interesting folks. Let me start first of all here and bring on here Michael Johns. Michael is the national co-founder and leader of the Tea Party movement. He's a former White House speechwriter and policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation. Michael, the argument is that the increased supply of high-quality heroin distributed through this wave of migrants employed as drug mules or recruited into gangs of the United States is a far more logical factor behind the new drug crisis. In your opinion, when we look at these two wars that are going on, the border, the battle of what's coming across the border, and then what's happening in the physician's room, into your doctor's room. What's behind the drug crisis in America?
Well, it's a complicated problem. There are many components of it that are not complicated. And the one that I think is the least complicating and the most obvious is the one you just referenced. And that is the need to secure the border, particularly with fentanyl, which is predominantly manufactured in China. Over 90% of that is being trafficked across our southern border. So the cost of the border wall, which we register and turn in many different ways, is right of not having that is right at the core of this problem. And why President Trump is absolutely right that southern border needs to be secured urgently. For this reason alone, it would need to be secured urgently. Then I think you get into the more complicating factors is that why have we spent so much time talking about the opioid crisis? Because it's a well-known gateway to heroin addiction. So it's in a sense created some of this demand. And I believe the opioid crisis itself, and this is pretty statistically documented, really blossomed on the watch of President Obama and for many different reasons. One is that the DEA under Obama went out and sought voluntary cutbacks in opioid distribution from legitimate manufacturers, as opposed to doing a lot of the street work that was necessary to cut back on street use. And the second thing that almost never is mentioned is that this crisis completely correlates with the expansion of the Medicaid program, which was a core component of Obamacare. And is this not common sense? But if you take very large percentages of poor people and afford them really easy access to street drugs, that drugs that can be sold on the street for high levels of profit, that at least some percentage of those are going to engage in that illicit activity. Yep. And while that doesn't comprise 100% of this problem, it was a major driving force behind it, and something, again, that no one really questioned, because this all looked like with Obamacare that it was being done on good intentions. And so you had, 2016, 64,000 overdoses, and of those, 42,000 came from opioids. I think the final point to make is that this is a crisis that's very much been attached with the struggling blue collar communities in Kentucky, in Indiana, in Ohio, in Pennsylvania, in West Virginia. And there's a pretty clear correlation with that demographic, that people, lose predominantly labor jobs, end up on opioids, and have transitioned into street use, predominantly because it's cheaper, and end up, at least some percentage of them end up being part of this addiction population and the overdose population. So it's a complicated problem, but securing the border clearly is not a complicated problem.
That's
that
right.
Should be the most obvious thing for our policymakers today.
And you and I have talked about that border wall, and we've done it many times here on that southern border. But, like everything, it's become very political. As I went to sleep last night and I thought about this conversation we'd have today with you and Dr. Ron, who I'll talk to in just a moment here, I started thinking in my mind about this whole drug epidemic and what's going on in the nation. And I started thinking about the people behind this, Michael, Ron, and people who are doing this. And I thought, why would anybody do that? Well, then the quick derivative, which you just pointed out, is money. The money behind the drug business is so, you could make an incredible life for yourself if you don't give a rat's ass about anybody else. And let's face it, there's a fair amount of the population who don't give a rat's ass about anybody. It's just, and you know what it is, people, I talk about this all the time, but this always comes back to the core argument of a fight of good versus evil. And this is centered to that conversation. And as I put my head on the bed last night, I started thinking about good and evil and this fight on drugs. And I was ripping pissed. And then when I started to see what's going on with the money our government spends away, like you say, they could put a wall up. No matter what a wall costs, a wall isn't even the tip money for lunch, people. It's not even the tip money. It doesn't matter what the wall costs. It's irrelevant. It doesn't matter. I mean, the money we spend in the kinds of dollars I just pointed out to you, we could do walls on top of walls and run them around the entire country and give walls to the rest of the countries and run them up. And I mean, we could put balloons on top of the walls every morning with fresh flowers for the gardeners to pick. I mean, there's enough. I mean, the money's not the issue here. For sure. Anyways, I'll tell you, I get on my box and I just can't get off of it. Dr. Ron Martinelli. So Dr. Ron is a retired police detective, a forensic criminologist, and a national voice known as the expert's expert. His book, The Truth Behind the Black Lives Matter Movement and the War on Police, is a must read. It's on Amazon. It's on the America Out Loud bookstore. Dr. Ron, you and I just had a bit of a conversation about some of these cartels on the Weekend Report on Viewpoint. And I had a lot of compliments come in on that because we hit a few nerves, clearly. I'd like to pick up on that a little bit. You hear Michael's open remarks, but let's go back to we got a dual war going on here. We'll get to Afghanistan in a moment, but let's stay on the border now and come back to the border and the cartels. Give folks a glimpse as to, because nobody can better speak about this than you, as to what's really going on, please.
Well, sure. As we discussed on Viewpoint, during the weekend, we have a number of transnational drug cartels, all of from Mexico, that transports the vast, vast majority of heroin and synthetic opioid fentanyl and methamphetamine into the United States. And just like we have states in the United States, these five cartels, there's actually six, but five predominant cartels have their own jurisdictions within our United States. And when you see a tremendous amount of cartel violence, that's predominantly at the border, because we have like the Sinaloa cartel, we have the Juarez cartel, we have the Gulf cartel, we have the Leyva Beltran cartel, and the New Generation cartel. So just like the mafia, the Italian mafia, these drug cartels establish jurisdictions, and then they have their lines of trade that come up from Mexico and penetrate through our various areas of our very porous border. So obviously, we need to get that border wall built, and I totally agree with you. It's a drop in the bucket compared to, you know, to build the wall is a drop in the bucket compared to the money in the tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars that the United States spends in our drug war, not only within the United States, but internationally. And of course, Afghanistan is one of those locations. So the cartels divide up the nation and start bringing tremendous amount of drugs. How much? Listen, just a week or so ago in Texas, the DPS, which is our Department of Public Safety, intercepted a former police officer from Mexico transporting 33 kilos of fentanyl. That's enough to kill 10 million people. So you could drop a couple of nuclear weapons on major metropolitan areas in the United States, and you wouldn't even come close to killing 10 million people. So, and that was his second trip across the border. The first trip across the border, I can guarantee you, he carried just as much, and he was not interdicted. So, obviously, all of these drugs coming across the border, especially this very dangerous drug, this synthetic opioid, fentanyl, is huge. So I know you were talking about some statistics at the beginning of the show, and I know Mike mentioned some. Let me give you a few more, just to put it in perspective. Is that okay?
Yeah, please.
Yeah. So between 2010 and 2015, during the Obama administration, the heroin and opioid deaths increased fivefold in the United States, and it went up. Just in 5 years, it went up 328%.
Wow.
And deaths during the last year, this last year, just in 1 year, death just from fentanyl and other synthetic opioids increased by 72%. That's in this last year. So Americans are increasingly becoming addicted to drugs, and we see a different demographic. And this is what is, to me, as a forensic criminologist that deals with the law enforcement community, this is a scary thought, because we are seeing far more younger people of the high school age and college age and blue collar workers and professionals getting addicted to these drugs. So let me just get into the physiology briefly, just so we can give our listeners some context. Is, you know, how do people get addicted to this? I mean, my God, fentanyl is a killing drug. How do average people get involved in this? Well, you have to remember that opioids, whether they're, you know, natural, synthetic, or illegal, and including prescription drugs. Now, you named a few of them. They, you know, the Oxycontin, the Percocet, the Vicodin, you named a couple of others. But what do they do to the body? Well, they act on the body's opioid receptors, and what that happens in the brain is it changes the brain and creates an addictive dependency on these drugs. Mm-hmm. So what happens physiologically is the body gets used to accepting a certain level of painkiller. But then, because of these opioid receptors in the brain, the dynamic is changed, and the brain requires the body now to take increasing doses, higher doses of these opioids, to the point where it's very difficult, and even for some people, impossible to taper off.
Well, and that's called an addiction right there.
Absolutely. But what happens physiologically, Malcolm, is why can't these people just turn it off, right? You know, you turn off smoking, you know, you do this. Why can't you turn it off? Because the body physiologically changes, and you get a lot of pain and upset stomach, something referred to as peristalsis. You have all sorts of things happening in the body. And of course, you go through the DTs, just like, you know, like a delirium tremors, like if you had alcohol, that's an analogous situation. Mm-hmm. So it causes the average person, not the person that's out on the street where we have people with mental health problems, or we have people that are addicted to alcohol and they self-medicate. These people are different. They are forced from their addiction to prescription medications to get up to higher levels of this drug. And so then they've got to go synthetic, right? And so here's where the street heroin and the fentanyl provides that respite for them. And it's killing Americans left and right. Now, you know, last week we talked about, I put it in perspective, the Vietnam War, which lasted for about 15 years, killed about 58,000 American soldiers.
In its entirety now.
In its entirety. Mm-hmm. Last year, we lost 32,000 Americans, and that is more
in one year,
and that is more. We lose more people per year, more Americans per year die from drug overdoses than in car crashes in the United States.
Right. So a lot of people are being caught unsuspectingly. Michael, what I'm thinking, to pick up where Ron is here now, I'm thinking that there's a lot of, like one of the stats I was reading here earlier today was on the veteran community and what's happening to our veterans who are suffering. In a lot of cases, pain and PTSD, PTSI, I mean, these are big problems with our veterans. And many of them are struggling with pain and war injuries and just all kinds of issues. And they're being caught in a real bad situation. But then I'm thinking also, Michael, you've got very unsuspecting people, just regular folks like all of us. And they're not necessarily looking to get addicted, but unsuspectingly, they do get addicted to these drugs. And then once it happens, once you're addicted, and here's another part of the crisis, and let's say the government has forced the doctors to stop prescribing them. In other words, there's a war against the medical industry to stop prescribing them. And a lot of them are being held hostage, and they're afraid of their medical insurances being discontinued and all kinds of crises happening in the doctor's office. And then what happens is some of these same people, I'm thinking, Michael, but speak to this, I think they're ended up buying them on the street. And I think that's adding to the street drugs. Is that a right assessment or not?
Well, definitely from the standpoint of illegal use, and it's kind of the definition of it, is being purchased on the street without prescription. And then there's another component of illegal use, which has been a subject of immense federal scrutiny lately and some pretty prominent federal raids and arrests of physician offices and pharmacies that have also been engaged in various kickback schemes related to the distribution. So the common denominator, when you really look at this on all aspects of this problem, and I mean the core of the problem, the distribution of the medications, the even the treatment of addiction itself has been money. Money has driven every one of these forces, and it's not received the level of real studied assessment and understanding that's necessary. And part of it is because a lot of the cliches, a lot of the common sense that has been brought to the discussion is not necessarily always true when you really drill down to the specifics. For instance, to parents of goodwill who might have a teenager or whatnot who's got a drug addiction problem might very commonly conclude that the best option for them is to put them in a treatment clinic. Mm-hmm. These treatment clinics, which have been recipients of immense amounts of federal and state funding, have proven hugely, hugely ineffective and are not necessarily, in many cases, the best methodology for dealing with addicts, particularly since we've had the good news here, a little bit of development in the pharmaceutical front with Suboxone, which is now much more effective than, say, traditionally methadone had been historically in treating this addiction. It really removed that craving that the doctor was explaining there about the way opioids work on the human brain. And it's proving immensely more effective yet that's not really been a core source of federal focus on that. The other good news, I think, that has come out of this is, you know, that we have Narcan now pretty widely available. I don't see any real compelling reason why this shouldn't be available, you know, with every emergency response team and maybe in every school that can reverse, you know, an overdose. So the funding, no one's denying that there's a need for funding in these areas. Mm-hmm. The border wall, as you correctly say, pays for itself and it's kind of like such common sense. Mm-hmm. We also need to, you know, be in these discussions with China, making it clear that there is no room for any additional involvement of China in this fentanyl crisis. They have been the predominant manufacturer of these medications. And one of the reasons is this is one of the biggest returns you could see on money anywhere. It costs about $3,000 of investment in fentanyl to get about $1.5 million in returns off the street.
It's a hell of an investment.
When you offer that kind of business proposition to somebody with any compromised ethics, they're going to seize on it. And that's been a big part of the problem.
Michael, what's China really up to? Speak to that point. I mean, this sounds, I mean, when you hear the way, and you've told me this before with China's involvement, what are they really up to? And why isn't something more done about this?
China has a very elaborate, sophisticated, studied plan to supplant the United States as the leader in the world. They are engaged in sophisticated efforts to divide this country, to cause problems within this country. They're challenging us militarily around the world. They're engaged in all sorts of very selfish and one-sided development programs in the developing world, where they're leaving countries with huge amounts of debt burdens for projects that aren't really even working. And these countries are actually like, you know, turning over and like ports and huge areas of collateral that they've had to offer to get these loans. So they're operating in very malevolent ways. And we do have a president for the first time who's up front and recognizing that, addressing it, you know, with this government. And, you know, if you don't have that, you're not going to make any progress. Even with that, it might be difficult, but I think that's happening. And the final thing that I would say in praise of President Trump is that this problem didn't receive a lot of attention for a long time. Then it got a lot of attention. But the one thing you have to say is it sort of was reaching its pinnacle, like right around when Obama was leaving. We're kind of into a second year of some modest progress here with the way this administration has been handling things and being more upfront about it and at least starting to put some focus on the border and raising these issues with China. And I think in allocating federal funds a little better than they have been historically.
And here's the crux. I can tell you this much. When we have as much infighting going on in our country as we have right now, and if we have the war and the divisiveness happening in our nation that we've had for some time, I mean, and then what happens is the battle is right here at home. And why do you think that you can see in the sidelines in the back there, China and Russia standing on the sidelines with their hands crossed across their chest, sort of in a cocky, hip-like attitude, like, we got you. You know, they just got to pick up the morning paper on any particular day, and they've got to be laughing their ass off. Truly and truly and truly. Between the whole Russia hoax and the China BS now and everything else that's going on as we fight the opium thing I talked about in Afghanistan out there and all of this nonsense of dollars. And then you have to stop and ask yourself, wow, I got news for you people. You know, void of any logic is an understatement for what's going on here. And the fight and the enemy is within. It's right here on the homeland of the United States of America.
Our global experts are brilliant writers and engaging hosts on a mission of a lifetime. You'll find the latest news and inspiration on the front page of AmericaOutloud.com.
This is Dr. Ron Martinelli, forensic criminologist and host of A Thread of Evidence on America Out Loud. If you'd like to find out what forensic criminologists really do in the field, and you're tired of the false narratives about law enforcement and want to unpack the cases that I've worked throughout the nation, then please pick up a copy of my new book, The Truth Behind the Black Lives Matter Movement and the War on Police, on sale right now at Amazon.com. That's the truth behind the Black Lives Matter movement and the war on police at Amazon.com.
Hello, this is Lieutenant Randy Sutton, the host of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I am a 34-year police veteran. I am also the founder and CEO of an organization that stands behind injured and disabled law enforcement officers. It is called The Wounded Blue. Our website is thewoundedblue.org. We have produced a film. It is an important film. I urge you to watch it. The film details what happens when a police officer or law enforcement officer is shot or stabbed or beaten or disabled, seriously injured in the line of duty. Most people think they are taken care of medically and financially. The reality may be quite different. It is called The Wounded Blue, Service, Sacrifice, Betrayed. The film is available on Amazon, iTunes, and the Microsoft Store.
And there are some people, friends, who are in serious pain. And I made that statement up front to you. So here's where I'm going to start in this next conversation here. What I want to ask, first of all, is, are they listening? And Dr. Ron, let's speak to that point as we bring back Dr. Ron Martinelli and Michael Johns here. Do you think that they're listening? And this doesn't stop the fact that many of these people will still become addicted to painkillers. And then when that runs out, as I said before the pause there, they're back out on the streets looking for a fix. And as you pointed out, the drug problem as a whole, isn't this the bigger problem? And then it's a cyclical kind of problem as we look at it. It is a very complicated topic. There's no doubt about it. But the question is the medical community, are they listening to the reports and the advice coming from the CDC and the FDA, do you think, at this point?
Yeah, I think they are. You know, the complicated issue here is that, you know, and I'm going to speak as a medical investigator, non-diagnostic, okay. But the problem with the physicians is they have the special relationship with patients where they need to help the patients. And sometimes when there is a significant amount of pain, and you know that young and old people suffer injuries, including catastrophic injuries, right, that require analgesics or some sort of pain medication regimen, right, mm-hmm, those doctors, through their Hippocratic Oath, are obligated to assist them in that. Now, they have to be very careful, and you know, they have to be very wary of the relationship with pharmaceutical corporations that, of course, want to sell them these very powerful painkillers. That being said, I see it from a law enforcement standpoint, where I take a look at two different demographics. Now, we're going to talk about the entire demographic, which is anybody that would be addicted to heroin, opioids, you know, synthetic, legal, illegal, prescription, whatever. Out of that entire group of people taking these medications, legal and illegal, you have those people that are basically the street people that have become addicted to drugs, and they are self-medicating, and they began medicating recreationally and then became self-medicating because of depression and despair and everything that's happening in their communities, in their neighborhoods. And if you just go around the country and you take a look now, right now, what is the city that most often is, you know, coming off the lips of people, President Trump, you know, Cummings, you know, everybody, is Baltimore, right? I'm very familiar with Baltimore, and it is a cesspool. And you take a look at Detroit, you look at Southside Chicago, you look at Los Angeles. I mean, you can bounce all around. You name the city.
City to city.
Okay, even Washington, D.C. And you're going to have that type of addiction. The problem is, and I think Mike referred to it, I'm going to look at it in sort of the same way, but from a different standpoint, is that you are returning. You've got all these clinics that are trying to break the cycle of addiction, but what are they doing? They are returning those people right back into those same neighborhoods with the depression and despair and no job skills, no education, you know, single family parenting or parenting being abandoned, and there's no leadership there at all. So what Trump is talking about right now, and he's taking on, you know, Elijah Cummings and some of these people, these are black leaders, and Maxine Waters is a great example too, that have brought zero to their communities, zero, yet they have taken hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, and squandered it away and have done nothing to improve the life of the people that are their constituency. And, you know, of course, in Baltimore, 67% of that population are people of color. That's that demographic. The second demographic is the people that we've been talking about. They're the high school students with sports injuries. They're the adults with sports injuries. They're older people. They're people that have been in car wrecks, and they start out quite honestly and innocently with prescription medications, then quickly develop a dependency, and now they are, you know, good people. I mean, who was a good person that was addicted to painkillers? Rush Limbaugh. I can't think of a more conservative person,
yeah.
All right? And you find a person of wealth and notoriety and who is an extremely intelligent person, Rush Limbaugh, and he admits at one time in his life, because he's totally sober now, but being addicted to prescription pain medication, mm-hmm. you can see where I'm going here. And that needs to be addressed as well.
Michael, you had a problem as well I want to touch on, just real briefly, because then I want to talk about some other things here. But back, you had a problem where you also didn't get addicted, though, when Ron talks about Rush. I just want to put out the fact that you can take these things and not be addicted. When you had a problem, what did you do? You broke your neck, I understand, or something like that, was it?
Right, yeah. Yeah, and I think before I get into those details, I mean, if you start with the question, are opioids good or opioids bad? Opioids are good when they're used as designed, and they're horrific when used as not designed.
Like everything.
You know, so it's really wrong and very easy to reach this conclusion. Opioids bad. Not necessarily. In fact, if you go back about 20 years ago within healthcare, one of the bigger issues was pain being undermanaged. This is not just an issue of, gee, well, someone's in discomfort, mm-hmm. but particularly with older patients that are, you know, maybe at risk of cardiovascular disease and other things, they become immobile because of the pain, and they develop all these secondary conditions that can be potentially...
Well, Michael, they're good. Lethal. Well, hold on. You bring up a great point about opioids. Let me interject, because you're saying that if they're used properly, Michael, and they're not out of context, and you're right with that statement. Let's make sure everybody understands that, because the opioid word itself has been tarnished badly. It's been put out there, and we all think, when we think of opioid, we are thinking of a complete crisis and meltdown and breakdown of all of this. And there's one other point to this that I think people should realize. All these narcotics do, and these drugs, these meds people, is this. In very simple layman's terms, as they do this. Think about it in these terms. From my vantage point, they just rewire your brain. It's just a mechanism the injury or the pain is still there. It's camouflaged because it's rewired your brain. So it's like an alternative route to the highway. If there was a car crash on the highway and you took a different route to get the hell around the car accident, that's my simple view of the world on pain meds. It rewires your brain around the pain. So if you think of it in those terms, that's, again, a layman's view on it, Michael. But you bring up an interesting point about the opioid thing out of context. Go ahead.
Well, you have a lot of patients that are in very vulnerable situations who need these medications. You take like a stage 4 cancer patient, who very almost uniformly, these are patients that are in enormous amounts of pain and need these medications, often administered through a patch where it's, you know, released incrementally throughout the day. Now all of a sudden you've got states and even the federal government looking at, well, let's maybe restrict access to these medications. They're arbitrarily going back to manufacturers and getting voluntary agreements to cut the manufacturing of them without any assessment of what the actual need is out there. So you've got pharmacies now that have product deficiencies, and you've got patients who are being put through efforts and harassment almost that they shouldn't have to. A stage 4 patient, for instance, a cancer patient, should not be having to go to the pharmacy every week because there's a five-day limit on an opioid prescription. These are really complicated issues, you know. So like in my case, I mean, I had probably as painful of a condition as you can have orthopedically, and a fractured neck, and then a botched surgery, and then a revised surgery that itself wasn't perfect. And then all of the associated issues, like literally the odontoid and the cervical spine fractured at some point, probably through athletics, discovered really abruptly, you know, went through college, no problems, was working several years, no problems. And then, you know, this emerged. And obviously, like from a standpoint of post-surgical management, it's even with a high pain threshold, it's almost impossible to imagine how you would get through that, how you would navigate it without some sort of opioid related.
But you never got addicted, pain. Right? You never got addicted. You never had a problem with it.
Yeah. You know, I think anyone who, I think these are gray areas, because I think like anyone who takes these medications for any period of sustained like time, I mean, by that, I mean, 2 weeks longer, is going to dip. Your body does, as you correctly said, rewires to it. When I ultimately just decided on my own, with a physician that was more than happy to continue them on me, that I think now was the time for me to stop doing it. Yeah, I went through like several days of immense discomfort. Two questions here. How do we stop illicit, illegal opioid use on the street that's being distributed in all the ways we described? And how do we ensure appropriate access for the many millions, we're talking about millions of Americans, who have a legitimate daily need for these medications as part of their healthcare management? These drugs are created for good reason, and it's important to do that. And that's why one of the concerns I've had, which is still is, I guess, being continued, is this arbitrary reaction that the DAA had to go out and force really on drug manufacturers this voluntary agreement to cut their manufacturing limits without an understanding of what the actual need is in these respective communities. And I understand what went into it. You had like certain areas of the country, like in one case, a pharmaceutical manufacturer doing the generics that was distributing like as much to Florida as it was to every other state in the country combined. And of course, yes, that was being, you know, misused. But as opposed to kind of doing the law enforcement work, the shortcut they've taken is going and blaming the manufacturers. And the manufacturers, there's been some really bad things that they've done, and they've been motivated by greed. There's been some marketing misrepresentation about the addiction levels, about the quantity and quality, the quantity of the medications that are needed. All of those things are really problematic. But ultimately, they don't have, once they release these medications, a whole lot of control over it. At that point, it really becomes an issue of what is the management of the distribution, the distributor, you know, companies like McKesson and Cardinal, others who distribute these. What is the responsibility of the prescribing physician? What is the responsibility of the pharmacy? And then what is basically being done from a law enforcement standpoint? And that's got to be, I think, the focus on the enforcement side. And then the treatment side, again, I think we have it totally wrong. We've got all this money pouring into these residential rehab programs that are performing, where like 4/5 of the people coming out of them are right back on illicit use, when we have an alternative with this emergence of Suboxone and combined with outpatient therapy that is far and away proven to be a preferable management for those people who have had heroin and other addictions.
When I talked about early on in the conversation with both of you about being void of any logic, I mentioned the country of Afghanistan. I'd like both of you to speak briefly, Dr. Ron, about this money. Now, listen to this here. This is very important in that we put a focus on this. We've spent in this war-torn country in excess of $100 billion dollars to rebuild, to try to rebuild Afghanistan. And most of it, none of it's being monitored properly. And most of it's been lost to waste and fraud and abuse and corruption. And then I mentioned, Ron, $9 billion to counter the narcotics efforts in Afghanistan, of the drug abuse in Afghanistan. What do you say to that?
First of all, we have a strategic security interest on two levels for subsidizing programs that deal with the elimination of drugs and drug trafficking in Afghanistan, and I'll speak to that in a minute. What are our strategic interests? Number one, in the older days, the Taliban, now the ISIS terrorists, use the production of opium and the sale of opium as a transnational drug cartel themselves to fund their terrorist activities, not only in the Middle East, but internationally. So that is the, and it's to our security interest and benefit to counteract that and interdict that. The second thing is that I'm not so sure we're that concerned about whether Afghanis are addicted to drugs or not. I think you already gave the statistic, which I think is accurate. But it is more about the transportation of those drugs into the United States, which obviously exacerbates that problem. So that's the first part of it. What are we doing there? What are we? Where's the money going?
We don't know. They don't know.
I can tell you where some of the money goes. Some of the money goes to subsidizing farmers and paying them for not growing.
Well, it was supposed to be that way, Ron, but it hasn't worked out that way, quite
frankly.
Well,
because the country's a cesspool, let's be honest about it. We've known that for eons.
Speaking of Baltimore or Afghanistan, just a moment.
I'm talking about Afghanistan. It's the same dynamic. You're dealing not as much with cultural issues. They've been growing opium since Christ was a corporal. Okay. But the whole thing now about selling it and everything and the huge market for it, by the way, it's an international market. You want to talk about addiction. You should look at the Russians. My God, you know, one of the reasons the Russians lost the war in Afghanistan is because their soldiers became addicted to opium. Mm-hmm. All right. So, and I'm not too far off what happened to us in Vietnam. Anyway, that's that thing. But, you know, Malcolm, could I take it just a step further and talk about the enforcement issue and what the problem is in the United States, in part as I see it on a daily basis? The mindset of Americans and jurists, mm-hmm, in the American justice system has got to change. These people that sell drugs in our country, mm-hmm, are killers. They poison our youth. They poison our adults. You get caught drug trafficking or selling drugs on the street in China, that's an executable offense. And they execute scores of people every single week for selling and trafficking in drugs in the United States.
They're in China, you're saying. But as Michael pointed out, they're happily sending them over here.
Of course, because it is within their strategic interest, mm-hmm, to addict Americans and basically break down the infrastructure of the United States of America. Okay, that is a long-term communist, Marxist, neo-socialist agenda. But we have to take a look at how our criminal justice system is currently being reformed. And it's not being reformed necessarily for the better good of people in the United States. We look at drug trafficking or, you know, street sales is a relatively minor offense now. We've got this whole second chance situation. And the vast majority of people involved in the second chance program are what? It's all drug related. Okay, it's not necessarily gang related. It's people that are using drugs, people that are trafficking, both larger quantities of drugs and then also street quantities of drugs, hand to hand sales, things like that. And we're turning those people back out. These people are all people that are poisoning our communities and destroying our infrastructure from within.
We're on a very bad trajectory here, I have to tell you. I continue to remind you on the Voice of a Nation, and this show today is centered to this conversation. It's centered to the fight on good and evil people. Got a couple of choices here. You can sit home, and you can sit on the sofa, and you can just ignore it all as the world passes you by. In the meantime, the country you love is going to hell in a handbag. Or you can get engaged and involved in the process, and I hope you'll choose the latter, people. It's time to get involved and get loud.